Welcome, and thank you for coming out on such a beautiful weekend. We get so few of them. I deeply appreciate your willingness to be inside. This kind of retreat, I'll just say a couple of words before I launch into talking about the topic, is meant to help us weave together our sitting practice with understanding of the Dharma that's come to us from our ancestors. And this weekend I'm going to be talking on a text that Dogen wrote. And I think most people here are familiar with Dogen, but he is our Japanese Zen ancestor who went to China before Zen had arrived to Japan, and he studied there, and then he brought back his understanding of the teachings of Zen, or Chan as it's known in China, to Japan. And he was in many ways really the first Zen teacher in Japan who really established a monastery, a training, and then wrote a lot trying to explain this particular view, this Dharma gate into awakening. You know, there is a kind of cliche almost in Zen, like they say, you know, throw out the sutras and just practice. And yet the shelves are filled, absolutely filled with writings of all the Zen ancestors, both in China and in Japan as well. So unlike retreats that you may have been to, this will be doing two Dharma talks each day, and then also discussing, having some time to talk with each other too in a kind of a structured way. And again, hoping to kind of weave together our understanding of the Dharma with our practice just a little bit more closely. The text that we're going to be looking at, and I'll pass that out in a few moments, is in Japanese called Kannon, which is the Bodhisattva of compassion, also known as Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit. And as you can see on the altar there, we asked Buddha to step aside for the weekend. And there's a beautiful kind of a Chinese carving of Guanyin, or Kannon in Japanese, Avalokiteshvara. And then if you go in the kitchen, on the little table there, underneath the big Enso, there's another Kannon riding a turtle. When I really love that one. I have a fondness for turtles. And then in the interview room, and you're welcome to also like just go in there during the lunch break and have a look, there's a Kannon that I carved many decades ago now when I lived in Japan. I was doing a Buddhist wood carving class. Compassion. You know, in our Zen tradition, compassion is not often formally discussed. And I think for those of us who are familiar with Buddhism in the West, this can seem a little bit strange, because all the other forms of Buddhism seem to spend quite a bit of time talking about compassion in one form or another. Certainly the Theravadan or Vipassana traditions, you know, they have compassion meditations, and it's often talked about in Dharma talks. Tibetan traditions, quite a lot have said about compassion and the development of compassion. The practice of Tonglen, a kind of meditation of giving and receiving. And of course, the Dalai Lama himself is said to be the embodiment of Avalokiteshvara, of compassion in the world. So I thought, darn, you know, we should say something about compassion. So for this weekend, I want us to consider what Dogen, this Dogen Zenji. Zenji is a little bit like a title, by the way. Sometimes I'll say Dogen Zenji because I'm so used to saying that, but just Dogen is fine. What Dogen has to say about one of the very few Zen stories or Zen koans that deal quite specifically with compassion. And I've wondered about this, you know, why doesn't Zen say more about compassion? And certainly I think there seems to be a kind of a common understanding, or assumption perhaps I should say, that, you know, our practice, which emphasizes wisdom, or this wisdom aspect of awakening, also just by the fact that it does do that, will also develop our capacity for compassion. But I have my doubts. I have my doubts. I don't think that they're completely divorced. But I know in my own practice, for me, it's also necessary and been very helpful to nurture compassion, to find ways to bring forth and develop my sense, my awareness of compassion, and to understand it better. What is it? What is compassion? What are we talking about when we use that word or a word that's similar to it? So these are some of the reasons why I thought, let's see what Dogen says about it, since he wrote this fascicle, this little chapter in one of his collections called the Shobo Genzo, called Avalokiteshvara, or Kannon in Japanese. So this chapter that he wrote it in 1242, so a few years ago. You may not remember those days. Some of you weren't born then. And he did it at the start of a summer retreat. When the summer retreat is when monastics would kind of intensify their practice. They stopped doing a lot of work, more meditation practice, dharma talks, that kind of thing. Often lasting for 3 months. So this text would have been something that probably he would have read, or somebody may have read, or maybe even people copied during this summer retreat. And this was about 14 years after Dogen had returned from China. So he'd been there, he had studied, but he'd been a monk, basically since he was a young teenager in Japan. Went to China as a young man, lived there, studied there for 3 or 4 years, and then came back with this kind of new understanding that he developed in China. About 3 years after coming back to Kyoto in Japan, he established his own small practice center. And that was called Kannon-dori Inn. Kannon-dori Inn. And that was in Uji, which is just a beautiful, it's a beautiful little tea town. Just
tea growing
town, just south of Kyoto. And he must have had a very special connection, I believe, to Kannon, to Avalokiteshvara, because he named his first temple Kannon-dori Inn. So there's something special about that. And which means, if I translate it, means the guiding power of Avalokiteshvara, the guiding power of Kannon. And there's also an interesting story about Dogen and Kannon, that apparently when Dogen was coming back from China to Japan, he was caught in a terrible typhoon. And these were days, of course, when many ships would disappear in the typhoons as they traveled back and forth between China and Japan. And he called upon Canaan and was saved. The ship did not sink, and he made his way back to Japan safely. Now, whether this is actually a true story or not, I'm not sure. It may just be one of the myths that arose after, you know, Dogen died, which seems to be the case with many, you know, kind of great people. These myths begin to attach to their stories. But in China and Japan, it certainly was and still is very common for those in trouble to call out to the Bodhisattva of compassion, to Avalokiteshvara, for help and aid. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow morning. So before we dive into the text, let me just say a few words about Avalokiteshvara, this Bodhisattva of compassion. Now, some of this you don't need to know about, so please let it go in one ear and not the other. But some of it you may find interesting. There are two original Sanskrit names for Avalokiteshvara. And I won't go into the details because that's just getting too linguistic. However, as a result, or at least scholars speculate, as a result, now we have two different names in Chinese and Japanese as well for Avalokiteshvara. So in Japanese, we have Kanjizai, which is the name of Avalokiteshvara that we chant in the Heart Sutra when we chant it in Sino-Japanese. And that literally means, or kind of one translation to translate that would be the one who freely perceives. And then another word is Canon, which I've already used, and that's a little more common usage when people talk about in Japan about Canon. That's probably the most common name for her. And it means the one who perceives the sound. And sound representing the cries of the world. The one who perceives and hears, perhaps we'd probably say, like all the cries of the world. So Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva, that special being who has dedicated their life to relieving the suffering of all the beings in the world. So Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva who hears the cries of those suffering in the world, who sees all their suffering and then acts to relieve it, brings forth compassion. And there are many, many stories about Avalokiteshvara, both in India, countless stories in China, and many, many, many in Japan as well. And I thought I'd like to mention just two of them to help us better understanding the text that we're going to dive into in just a moment here. So the first story is how Avalokiteshvara became awakened. What was her awakening experience? And this one, and there's many variations, by the way, is found in a very large sutra called the Surangama Sutra. Now, I'll read you a translation of it here. So, in this sutra, various bodhisattvas and people are standing up and telling about their awakening experiences, their ways of practicing, basically, how they practice. So, just diving in here. Whereupon Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva rose from her seat, prostrated herself with her head at the feet of the Buddha, and declared, "I still remember that long before numbers of eons, countless as the sands in the Ganges," typical expressions in these, give you an idea of the vastness of time that they appreciated. This is in India, these kind of expressions that arose. A Buddha called Avalokiteshvara appeared in the world. Now that I found interesting, that here we have a Buddha also called Avalokiteshvara in an early sutra. Anyway, when I was with him, I developed the Bodhi mind, which means the mind of awakening. And for my entry into samadhi, into a deep meditation, I was instructed by him to practice meditation by the means of the organ of hearing. At first, directing the organ of hearing to the stream of meditation, both the stream and the subject which enters it became quiescent. So by listening, I became one with the sound, and everything just settled. Everything became quiescent. Both movement and stillness were clearly non-existent. So I didn't, there was no discrimination between movement and non-movement. Right? Just thus advancing step by step, both hearing and its object cease completely. No distinction between what is heard and what you and the act of hearing itself. But I did not stop when they ended. Not abiding in awareness of this state, both awareness, awakening, and the object of awareness, me, were realized as empty. Enlightenment became perfect. Both creation and extinction were extinguished, and the state of nirvana manifest. Avalokiteshvara, of course, as you can probably tell by her name, finds awakening through the practice of listening, the meditation of listening on sounds. And this is still practiced today and encouraged at many Zen centers as a way to quiet the mind, settle the body, and enter a state of samadhi through listening to sound. And of course, as you listen to sound, you don't like, oh, there's the dog. Yeah, it's just the sound almost goes right through you with this practice. So, Avalokiteshvara used the Dharma gate of hearing. And so it's natural that she now continues this practice by listening to the cries of the world. But there are so many crying out and needing help. I'm one of them. I'm sure there may be one or two others here sometimes crying out, help me. There's one famous story about Avalokiteshvara that I'm going to relate next. And that is when she made a vow to never rest until she had freed all sentient beings from the suffering of this world, she turned to deeply listening for any cries that she could hear. And yet, despite her strenuous efforts, still many unhappy beings were caught up in dukkha, caught up in their suffering. And striving to help so many, her head split into 11 fragments. It exploded with all the suffering that she was trying to deal with. And at that moment, Amitabha Buddha, this kind of archetypal Buddha, who is kind of a Buddha of compassion, really, was so moved by her great efforts that he transformed the 11 pieces, kind of lying on the floor, I guess, into 11 heads. So that she could better perceive all of those suffering, kind of make more channels for her to hear the cries of the world. And then once again, hearing so many crying out for help, Avalokiteshvara attempted to reach out to all of those in need, but making such great effort that her two arms shattered into pieces. And seeing this, Amida Buddha assembled all those pieces and created for Avalokiteshvara 1,000 arms and hands so she can better aid us all. Canon is the most popular bodhisattva in the Mahayana tradition. And she's said to appear in at least 33 different forms, some of them are listed in these texts. And this fascicle, this chapter that we're going to read, begins with a well-known story, or koan, that is a discussion between two monks about canon. And I'll talk more about these two monks in just a moment here. And this canon is known as, or this Avalokiteshvara is known as, the thousand-armed canon, the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, the Senju canon, whose great compassion and great compassionate activity is expressed through 1,000 arms. And each palm is said to have an eye so that she can better see what's necessary. Now, you may never have seen Canon with 1,000 arms. So I brought a book that I have that's on Canon. It's in Japanese, but it has some lovely pictures, so I thought I would just show you a couple before we dive into the text. And I'll leave this out afterwards. You can have a look at lunch. So here, this is a very beautiful wooden statue of her. You can see, although she just has two arms in this one, you can see the many heads that are there. And you'll also notice that on the crown of her head, often they carve a little Buddha, standing Buddha. And this Buddha is Amida, or Amitabha Buddha, the Buddha who kind of fixed her up. And then in the center is the wood carving of her with the 1,000 arms. And you can see many of the arms are also holding some kinds of instruments or implements, and these are used as a kind of, where depending on the circumstances, so she's prepared. I kind of think of it as like the ultimate Boy Scout knife. And the last one I want to show is there's a very famous temple in Kyoto called the Sanju San Gendo. And here, this is if you ever go to Kyoto, you have to go visit this temple. Here we see larger than life-size statues of Kanon in this long, long row. Do you remember how many there are of them? Lots.
Lots. I forget.
Yeah.
It's not 1,000.
I think 1,000. I was going to say 1,000.
1,000, yeah. Well, and in the center, there's a big one of her with 1,000 arms, and then, but I think there may be 1,000 of these. So. Very beautiful. But please have a look at this afterwards. Okay. So now, the text. And we're not going to read like every line of the text, but I'm hoping we'll cover a lot of it as we go through here. Okay. So just before we launch in, let me just say a couple of words about the two characters here, Dawu and Yunyan. So this koan, this story that Dogen is picking up here, is actually in a number of these koan collections. Blue Cliff Record and A Book of Serenity. And Dawu and Yunyan appear in a number of different stories, not just this one. And they're kind of favorites of mine. They were brothers. They were perhaps real brothers, but they certainly were Dharma brothers. Dawu being the older brother, and Yunyan being the younger. Dawu is said to have been about 10 years older, so he often takes the role of, or the seeming role of being like, you know, the guy who knows. Yunyan, the younger brother, being the one who doesn't. But we need to take that with a grain of salt here. Because they are just roles. And with the Zen koans, we can't be sure of anything. That's their way of teaching us. So let's read this together out loud first. Okay. So I'll just read the first line then. So Yunyan, who would later become great master Wuzhu, asked his senior Dharma brother, Dawu, who would later become great master Shuyu. I'll stop there. Now, could someone please be Yunyan? Good. And Dawu? Okay, good. So do you want to just take it from there? Just take it off with what does.
Oh. Like someone reaching back for the...
Wait. Yeah.
Ask the question.
Flow first.
What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes?
Like someone reaching back for the pillow at night.
I got it.
What did you get?
All over the body are hands and eyes.
You have said it well, but it's 8 or 9 out of 10.
I am just this. How about yourself, brother?
Whatever the body reaches, it is hands and eyes.
Hmm. Great, thank you. And I just want to say for the last line here, it's often translated different ways. Or actually, things are always translated different ways, but one popular way is throughout the body. Nothing but hands and eyes. Mm-hmm. Throughout the body, nothing but hands and eyes.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite.
Yeah, that's Kate's favorite. Okay. So now what I'd like you to do is think about this for, we'll take up just about 2 to 3 minutes. And I'd like you can write down on the paper if you like, or on your own notes. I'd like you to somehow respond to this a little bit. What meaning do you take? What does this tell you? What kind of meaning, perhaps, do you pick up from this? Or implications do you glean from this sort of dialogue? What do you think it's telling us? And anything that seems strange or challenging to you? So just kind of jot down your thoughts, your feelings, your reactions, your response.
Small group.
Okay, so even if you haven't quite finished yet, that's fine. Because now you'll get a chance to just talk about it with each other. And what I'll ask you to do is maybe just get into groups of three, and then we'll have maybe one group of four.
And I'll sit in on one of the groups of three, but I want other people to have...
Right. And what I would like you to do is basically self-time. We'll take about five minutes, maybe a little bit longer.
Each person, maybe a couple.
Yeah, a couple, about 2 minutes, about 6 to 8 minutes. I'll kind of get a sense of it as I listen to people talking. And I'd like you just to reflect on what came up for you as you wrote. So you don't have to say everything necessarily you wrote, but just, you know, what came up for you, what's strange, and just tell each other. And feel free to, you know, ask questions. What did you mean by that? Okay? So if you get together in your little group, and then first of all, just introduce yourself. Say who you are, your name, and then begin.
The one before.
Okay. So maybe I'll just have people read a little bit, and then I'll cut. So maybe starting with Susan, would you read the first little paragraph right after the dialogue there?
Although there have been a number of statements about Avalokiteshvara before and after Union and Daowu, they are not as good as the statements made by these two. If you want to study Avalokiteshvara, you should thoroughly investigate their words.
Hmm. So Dogen obviously has a pretty strong view about this dialogue. And it's true, there are many, many writings about Avalokiteshvara in the various sutras and commentaries, but Dogen is holding this up as being really important, even though at first glance it may seem kind of short and an insignificant dialogue. So, what is so great about this koan? And why should we take note of it? That's what we need to kind of consider. Okay, Michelle, do I read the next paragraph?
The Bodhisattva of great compassion is Avalokiteshvara, one who perceives the cries of the world, also called one who has complete freedom in perceiving. This Bodhisattva is regarded as the parent of all Buddhas. Do not assume that this Bodhisattva has not mastered the way treasury of the true Dharma
as much as
Buddha.
That's strange, yeah.
In fact, Avalokiteshvara was true Dharma illumination, Tathagata, in a previous life.
Okay. Well, this is interesting. So he, first of all, just explains a little bit about the name of Avalokiteshvara. And I've already talked a little bit about Bodhisattva, and so I think I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit here. But what I do need to say about Bodhisattvas is that the traditional view, as it arose in India, is that a Bodhisattva is a being on the way to become a Buddha, right? And the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, our tradition, of course, encourages everyone to take bodhisattva vows, to, you know, to try become a bodhisattva. And we chant those every full moon here, right around the full moon. But Dogen twists something here, and this is something very common that Dogen does in his writing. He twists the standard view around and warns us not to assume that a bodhisattva is in any way less than, it is in any way deficient or less than a Buddha, right? So I say, I don't think that this is like second rate. You're not getting second rate stuff here. In fact, he says, Avalokiteshvara was a Buddha named True Dharma Illumination, Shobo Myo. And that's interesting. So perhaps Avalokiteshvara realized, you know, I can actually do more good in the world as a bodhisattva than a Buddha. And without going into the kind of the historical views behind all this, is that but basically a bodhisattva is in the world. A Buddha in some way has separated from the world. But there are more, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of exceptions in this in the literature, but that's the general idea. Now, I did a little bit of research and I couldn't find any reference to this true Dharma illumination, Tathagata. Tathagata is another word for Buddha, basically. But what's interesting and important for us is Dogen is cautioning us here not to make assumptions. Not to make assumptions that we know. Oh yeah, but you know, Buddha's like at the top, next is a bodhisattva, and we're like, you know, down here, level 26, working our way up. Don't make any quick or rash judgments. Don't accept the standard teachings, the standard views. He does this over and over again throughout his writings. He turns things on their head to shake us up. Don't assume a bodhisattva is any less than a Buddha. Don't assume that you know who you are or what you're capable of. Avalokiteshvara is the parent of all Buddhas. Maybe he's saying, you know, compassion is the parent of all Buddhas. And perhaps, you know, our common view, our kind of, you know, Zen-y view, that years of meditation and study is what leads to awakening, is not quite right. Maybe it's compassion that gives birth to awakening. Maybe that's what Dogen's telling us here. Let me just read, I'll just read the next, could you read the next two sentences?
The next two sentences?
Yeah, study and focus.
Study and focus on Yunyan's words. What does the bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? There are schools of Buddhism that cherish Avalokiteshvara and schools that have no relationship with this bodhisattva.
Good, let's stop there. So what does the bodhisattva of compassion do with so many hands and eyes? This is the question that we will keep close to us during this retreat. And our life, I hope, afterwards as well. At first glance, when we read this text, it seems some Buddhist traditions, you know, cherish and venerate Avalokiteshvara and others don't. And it is true, you know, Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva mostly of the Mahayana tradition. Tibet, China, Korea, that's where the tradition is most strong, Vietnam, and of course Japan. But I did read recently that in many temples in Thailand, they have statues of Avalokiteshvara as well. In fact, it's the only bodhisattva that you'll see fairly frequently in Thailand. And many of them have a kind of Chinese form to them, from what I was reading. So maybe it's a Chinese influence, Chinese immigrants' influence into Thailand. I kind of think the love of Avalokiteshvara, the appreciation for her, is kind of infectious. I think it spreads. But I think there's another way to look at this expression about there are some schools that venerate and some schools don't. Another way to look at this may be that there are times when we commit to planned acts of compassion. In other words, we plan it out, we realize what needs to be done, we take steps to ensure that, you know, everything is necessary to accomplish this particular act. We join charity organizations, give our time, whatever, those kind of things. And we can clearly see that these are, this is compassion, right? It's very kind of clear. This is an act of compassion. But there are also those spontaneous acts of compassion, like helping someone who has just fallen or about to fall, comforting a frightened child. And these are less clearly seen in that we act without an intention or plan that's already there. We don't have a plan to relieve suffering. We just reach out and do it. I think this is what Dogen is implying here. When I look at the original language, the Japanese that he wrote here, it's not so much he's pointing out differences between two traditions of Buddhism as implying that there are times, perhaps when it's rational. You know, we act very compassionately in a very kind of carefully, well thought out way. And then there are times we don't. It's done without a thought. So I think we'll stop here and we'll go back to sitting, but I'd like to leave you with a question. What is compassion? What is compassion? How would you recognize it? And again, just as we did during the second sit, I'd like you maybe just bring it forward, consider it as we begin our next sit, and then let it go. Let it go. But just evoke it before you begin your meditation. So we'll pause here.